underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In her admired works of fiction, including the recent The Book That Matters Most, bestselling author Anne Hood explores the transformative power of literature. In her new book, Morning Star, she reveals the personal stories behind the beloved novels in her life. She is the author of the best-selling novels The Book That Matters Most, The Knitting Circle, The Red Thread, The Obituary Writer, and Somewhere Off the Coast of Maine. It is a great pleasure to welcome Anne Hood to this week's book show.
Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure. So what got you thinking about writing about your love of books?
Well, last year I had a novel come out called The Book That Matters Most.
Right.
And I should have anticipated that every interview would ask me what book mattered most to me, but I didn't. So every time I got that answer, that question, I thought, what book does matter most to me? And I began thinking about the books I'd read, mostly in high school, to use as kind of a blueprint for the life I was imagining. And once I started thinking about that, I started rereading them. And it sort of brought me back to this joy of reading that I had as a young girl. And next thing I knew, I had 10 of these essays about that.
In these essays, what ultimately did you want to look at and explore? I mean, were these very concrete questions that came to your mind that you looked to answer?
Well, you know, I was a kid from a small town, very economically depressed, an Italian-American family, and I just had this yearning that I could not name for a different life in a different place. I had a perfectly lovely family. I was a happy kid, but I just had these big dreams. In that town, the teachers in my school and even my own parents didn't know how to help me have those dreams come true. And so I turned to books kind of to learn how to live. So, for example, when I read Dr. Zhivago, oh, yes, I loved the romantic part, but it was like learning about the big world out there, descriptions of Russia. If I read a French novel, it was like going to Paris. That taught me how to travel. When I read The Bell Jar, I thought about the fragility of creativity. And all of these were the things that I was thinking about but couldn't articulate, so books helped me do that.
I do want to get into the individual books in just a moment, but before we do, I was taken by the way you phrase it within the book, which is these are lessons mm-hmm. that you learned through these books.
You know, I thought about that as I was writing about each book. I realized I can actually point to what this taught me, and suddenly it became clear that books were my teachers, so I was getting lessons on how to live life through them.
It seems in the book as though you are going somewhat chronologically. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, some overlapped because I was such a big reader and I read, as I say in the book, very big books. I chose the books I read mostly by heft because I could only get to the library once a week.
Which brings us to the first lesson, How to Dream, and Herman Wouk's Marjorie Morningstar, which, yes, some heft there, huh?
Yeah, it sure is, yeah. And you can tell by the fact that I used Morningstar in the title of this book, the effect that that book had on me. Here I was, a blue-collar Italian-American kid in a small town in Rhode Island. And when I read about Marjorie Morningstar, an upper-middle-class Jewish girl growing up in Manhattan, I thought Herman Wouk had seen into my soul. And I realized part of the power of literature is that it is so universal that you think the writer actually knows who you are and what you want.
How vividly do you remember reading that book for the first time?
I remember that one so well. Now, I confess, I have reread it kind of a lot. I love that book so much, and I still cry at the same places. But I remember sitting in my room, which is where most of these books were read. I had a yellow and white gingham bedspread with matching curtains, but I spent one summer stringing beads to make a curtain of beads in the doorway. It was the 60s. And I remember sitting there and sobbing when the boy who loved her, now a man, visits her and she's given up her dreams and she's a suburban housewife. I sobbed, and I still cry at that part, but I remember so clearly sitting there crying.
You start off the chapter about that book and talking about a Time magazine review in which they referred to it as an outmoded adolescent cliche. I assume you didn't read that at the time, that came later. But what does it do when, because it's somewhat like attacking your children, right?
No, absolutely. One of the things about growing up with books, about this new book of mine, is I didn't choose always literary books to include. And Marjorie Morningstar, which also was a really good movie with Natalie Wood that I liked a lot, I didn't know the difference between a literary book and this kind of book. If a book talked to me, I'd reread it and reread it and put them at sort of the same level of care and love. And so when I reread them, some of them did not hold up to the test of time. You know, I realized, I don't know why I liked this one so much. But Marjorie Morningstar, I have to debate Time magazine on this one.
I want to read just one line that you have in this chapter. But at 15, that first time I read the novel, I thought that Herman Woke had somehow climbed into my brain and emerged with my story. And I guess that gets to really our growing up with books and why they become so important, because we feel that they speak to us at that particular time.
Absolutely. You know, I'm doing publicity for the book, and I've given just a couple readings from it so far. As soon as I finish, there is a line of people who want to tell me what their books are, the ones that changed them.
Right.
They don't even have to think about it. You know, it's really when you find that book that works its magic on you, you never forget it.
Do you think, and I will get to some of the other books in a moment, but do you think we ever grow out of it in the sense of that is a book that spoke to us at that moment? And then when you reread it years later, I felt this way maybe a little bit with Catcher in the Rye, where when I read that when I was a kid, oh my God, it was like it was written for me. And then when you read it later as an adult, you're like, oh, okay.
I think that happens. I mean, isn't there some advice, some famous advice, like you have to read Hemingway every 10 years because you're going to love him and then hate him and then re-love him? And I'm not sure if that's true.
That sounds true. So, but these are the books, and it seems in your writing about these lessons that are books that have stayed with you, that you read so often, that you revisit because they are so important to you and continue to speak to you.
That's exactly right. You know, a woman showed me her very dog-eared copy of Jane Eyre, and in the back, she rereads it every year, and in the back, she writes the date that she read it each year. So she showed me these two pages of dates. You know, she just loves that book so much. So that would be her, you know, book that matters most when she'd include in her book of the books that changed her.
Of course, for you as a writer, you mentioned The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath, and you use that as an example, as a lesson, how to become a writer. And that idea of, for you now being a writer, of that book comes to you and speaks to you and teaches you.
Yeah, you know, what was interesting is I read that in high school and I never read it again until last year. And I did not remember how funny that book is. I mean, it's very sad too, but the humor is great. The observations, the eye for detail. I mean, I really enjoyed rereading The Bell Jar. And I remembered really well the beginning when she's in New York City and she's a Mademoiselle, you know, college editor, and there's like eight of them. And I remembered so much about that and not so much about what had happened after. When I reread it, it brought back to me this feeling I used to have, like I was a giant nerve ending. And I felt everything so acutely as a teenager, and I had great insomnia because of it. And my mother would wake up at like 3 a.m. and hear me still awake and get in the car and take me to Dunkin' Donuts, where we would sit until sunrise. And then I would go back to bed and she'd go to work. I used to think, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I'm going crazy. And I realized that that's one of the reasons The Bell Jar affected me so much, is because of what happens to Esther in it.
And because, like you, Esther wanted to be a writer.
That's right. That's
and was right. headed down a good path.
Yes. Yeah, so there was really this incredible lingering sense of fragility that somehow is connected to creativity.
When you look at these books for their content, I was taken in the book by you also write about them as objects too, how they smell, how they feel, a paperback, a hardcover, one from the library, one that you get.
Yeah.
That has a lot to do with it too. There's that sensory allure to the book as well.
Isn't that the truth? I still do that. When I get a new book, I fondle it for a very long time before I read it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love the way it feels. I love looking at the author photo. I love smelling books. It's a real tangible experience.
Do you think that that has an impact on, in some, whether it's conscious or subconscious, on how the book speaks to you? That if it felt differently, that maybe it wouldn't?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure, because some of the books, Dr. Zhivago comes to mind again, that was definitely a library book. And it had a certain smell that libraries have that helped transport me to Russia. Do you know what I mean? I was carried off, not only in the words, but in that smell. When I opened that book, it was like a portal into that story.
Ann Hood is our guest on this week's book show. The new book is Morning Star. It is published by Norton. You tell the story in the book about how to buy books, and you refer to Love Story by Eric Segal, which is very much a book of its time, right?
Yes, yes.
So tell us a little bit about that experience, of what you learned about buying books from Love Story.
Yeah, so I had, as a younger kid, you know, when I was maybe 7 or 8, I used to spend my allowance on Nancy Drew books. And I had them all lined up, all those yellow bindings, you know, facing out. I loved them. But when our mall opened and we had a Walden Books in it, it was the first bookstore I'd ever been to. The experience of walking in out of the mall, there was a Spencer's Gift on one side and like a steakhouse on the other. So right in front of the bookstore, you smelled like incense from Spencer's Gift and you smelled steaks cooking. And then you stepped into the bookstore and just had this smell of books. And they had hardcovers, bestsellers in the front, and then like a rack of paperbacks. And I remember Love Story catching my eye. Now, I wasn't really aware of things like book reviews and bestseller lists. I just went by the look of the book, the size of the book, you know, maybe what it said in the flap. But that book just jumped out at me. And I remember opening it, and, you know, that first line is something like, you know, what do you say about a 26-year-old girl who dies or something like that.
Right.
And I thought, I have got to read this book. And I would go in and just try to read a page every time I was at the mall. And then I had this brilliant idea to buy it as a gift for my cousin who loved to read. I did for Christmas, and I brought it home. And I read the entire book without cracking the spine. You know, I held it on its side and I looked down at it so that she wouldn't realize I'd already read it. And I realized that there was such a power in buying a book and owning a book, even though I gave that one away for the day and a half that I owned it myself. It just felt like I had found, you know, sort of like a treasure chest. And of course, now I own so many books, but I still have the same feeling when I get a new book and when I read it and then when I put it in its place on the shelf, I step back and look at it. I don't, they're like family members, you know?
You mentioned treasure chests, but you also write in that essay about Love Story of realizing the cost of the book, too, of what that meant to you as a teenager, of having to pay that much money for the book.
Oh, yes. And my mother thought buying books, and I think she probably still does, was a waste of time, of money. And I would get sort of scolded for buying those Nancy Drew books. So I was actually kind of afraid when I spent whatever it was on a hardcover book like Love Story. I was actually afraid of her reaction. I don't remember her reaction, so maybe I slipped it past her. I'm not sure.
Ann Hood is our guest. The name of the book is Morning Star, Growing Up with Books. It is published by Norton. Many of the books that you talk about, The Grapes of Wrath, Dr. Zhivago, Marjorie Morningstar, even Love Story are classics, are still considered classics. And every once in a while you slip one in that I was either unfamiliar with or found it interesting that you, as a young woman, was reading Dalton Trumbo.
That is a book I love and I have reread more than once and continue to be incredibly moved by it. You know, you have to remember, like you were saying, Love Story is such a book of its time. Well, that time, the 60s, we grew up with the Vietnam War playing on television. Like, I just remember sitting in front of the TV with my Jiffy Pop popcorn, you know, scorched popcorn, and watching the war. And I think that's why that book was reissued, was because we were in another war. And I think Dalton Trumbo wanted it to be read again. It's actually about World War I. But it's, I don't know, pacifist point of view, and its telling of the horrors of war stayed with me forever. I think it's a book everyone should read.
You have a great essay in the book about how to be curious, and you talk about reading Victor Hugo and Tolstoy and Dickens, and also Jacqueline Suzanne and Harold Robbins. books are books, right? You don't discriminate. And so, even the trashy one can be good.
Absolutely. You see what I mean? I would hold A Stone for Danny Fisher by Harold Robbins in the same regard as I would hold Grapes of Wrath. It's kind of funny when I say that.
And why do you think that is? It's because it spoke to you at the time, I assume.
Absolutely. It had the power to transport me. You know, I think reading has two gifts, many gifts, but two of them. One is that it takes you away, it distracts you, it takes you out of your life and puts you somewhere else. And the other thing it does is help you understand the world in which you live. I mean, they seem like opposite things, but it has the ability to do both. And so surely A Stone for Danny Fisher took me out of my world and my comfort zone, you know, big time. But it also helped me understand the world in a new way.
I noted a paragraph in that chapter where you write, "There's lots of sex in A Stone for Danny Fisher, though often I couldn't tell if he had just kissed someone, actually had sex with her, or just felt her breasts." More than once, I had to reread scenes confused by Danny's feelings of guilt after being with a girl, but second and even third reads left me just as confused. Perhaps these vague sex scenes were just right for my naive teenage self, enough to titillate, but not enough to terrify me.
Exactly. I think it suited my purposes just fine. Even now, I reread this book last year, and those are the funniest sex scenes you've ever read. You don't know what the heck's going on.
Did doing this project allow you to read everything again?
Oh, you know, I read all of the books that I write about. I read again and read reviews of them and, you know, any kind of cultural information I could find out about them, because that helped me place myself back in that time, you know, that I read them. But I'll tell you, this book could have been five times as long. There are so many books that I loved that I couldn't include, you know, that just because of time and space. But I was a big lover of a writer named Fred Mustard Stewart. Have you ever heard of him?
I have not.
Yeah, The Mephisto Waltz was the book I loved of his. And I also loved Evan Hunter, in particular a book he wrote called Sons, which was about three generations in a family. So they're in World War I, World War II, and Vietnam. Mm. Anyway, I could go on, but you could see why I had to stop at some point.
And making a list of anything is difficult, right? I mean, you're always going to leave something out, and even if I assume if you read this book in 5 years, you'll think, oh, why didn't I put this in?
Absolutely. The lessons were plentiful, and the books were plentiful.
But again, there are books that you're certainly not alone in having great need for reading and learning so much from them. You write about Rabbit Run, John Updike. That book obviously had an effect on many people, including you.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because, again, I just picked it off because it was big and fat, off the library shelf. And it was one of those books that seduced me from the first page. I mean, Marjorie Morningstar, we can kind of make the leap. Well, two young, dreamy girls who want to be artists of some kind. Yeah, I see the similarity. But the fact that I thought Harry Rabbit, you know, was me, is really interesting to me to think about. You know, he's a former basketball star. I can't dribble a ball from life of me. But I realized when I was revisiting it that, of course, he's in a small town and he wants to get out and he has big dreams and he doesn't know how to articulate them or follow them. And I think that's the part of that book that really spoke to me. I also, like many readers, develop literary crushes. And one of mine was on Rabbit. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I had a crush on Mark Antony. I read Julius Caesar the same year.
Obviously, we never stop learning lessons. But for you, was there a point in your life as you were putting this book together that you said, oh, okay, I want to go until adulthood or put a sort of chronological age on the point where the lessons stopped?
Right. No, you know, I think there was a natural end to it, which is when I went to college. From my first English class, I was an English major, and from my first English class, when that teacher, Nancy Potter, handed out the syllabus, it was the first time someone told me what to read. You know, I felt like she gave me a map or a secret. And I looked down at those books. I remember My Antonia by Willa Cather was on that list, Humboldt's Gift, John Cheever's The Falconer. And I didn't know a lot of those books, and I just felt like I had been given this privilege of being told what to read. But I also realized that a lot of the books I had read, other students hadn't read, and it sort of set me apart that I was the true English major, you know, that I had already read Rabbit Run, for instance, and John Cheever's stories. It was a natural ending because I entered a world in which people read books and talked about them and guided me. My self-education ended then.
You look back at these books, the books that meant something to you before you go to college. Is there ever a change? And when you read them now as a writer, I mean, this is your profession. This is what you do.
Right.
So you read them as a writer, and I assume you read them not only as a reader, but as a writer and someone who this is their profession. So do you read them differently at all? And do your opinions ever change?
Well, you know, I think you're hitting on something important. In a way, being a writer ruins the reading experience for you because you can't help but read any book with that writer's eye, either trying to figure out how the writer accomplished what she did or how you would do it differently or how it could be better. You just can't help yourself from that critical reading, you know? And part of writing this book that was wonderful was it returned me to the purer joy of reading, the pre-writer me. I just heard the poet Ed Hirsch read a poem, and he said he had written this particular poem because he wanted to remember what it felt like to be so excited by poetry. And when he said that, I thought, yeah, that's kind of why I wrote Morningstar growing up with books, because it returned me to that purer state, which was lovely to be in.
That idea of being introduced to reading so early, I mean, I was the son of a librarian, so my mother had a library card in my hand when I was a toddler.
Lucky and, you.
And I remember that experience so vividly. Yeah. So, and I remember her saying, I said, what can I take out? And she said, you can take out whatever you want, but let me know what you think of it and kind of report back.
Right.
So for you, in your looking at this as of how these books spoke to you, how do you think we propel that for future generations of getting people to put these books in their hands so they learn lessons too from different books?
Oh, wow. You know, both of my kids, I have a son who's 24 and a daughter who's 13. And maybe like you, they had no choice but to be big readers. You know, they've got a mom who's a writer and who language and words and books are so important. And I think that that's kind of the key to put books in the hands of children when they're young and show them the magic of it. The lessons they're going to learn are going to be theirs. I read my daughter The Lottery, the Shirley Jackson story the other day.
Yep.
Because I remember reading it at her age and I loved it. And she looked at me and said, why did you think I wanted to hear that story? To me, it said so much about living in a small town. You know what I mean? I related to it, and she just had no connection. So we share our love of stories, and we share the stories we love But the lessons come from places we can't predict or control.
The book is absolutely beautiful. It's called Morningstar, Growing Up with Books, and it is published by Norton. Ann Hood, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking to you.
Once again, Ann Hood's new book is Morningstar. It is published by Norton. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.